I'm delighted now to welcome Catherine Plesko. She's a planetary scientist at Los Alamos National Laboratory, and tonight at 6 o'clock she will lead a student discussion called Heads Up, Protecting the Earth from Large Asteroid Impacts at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Annex, or Education Annex, at 123 Grant Avenue. It's part of the Santa Fe Alliance for Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So let's talk about asteroids. And I mean, just basically, what are asteroids?
So asteroids, and actually comets as well, I didn't include them in the title just for brevity, but asteroids and comets are the leftovers of the formation of the solar system. So we're sitting here this morning in a bakery, and they make lots of good pastries and tasty things like that. And once they're done making the pastries, they have lots of scraps and crumbs that are left over from that process. So asteroids and comets are actually the same thing for the solar system. They're the leftover bits that didn't become planets or part of a planet. They're the leftover bits of asteroids are the rocky leftover bits, and they're the ones that formed in the inner solar system near where the Earth and Mars and all the inner rocky planets formed. And comets are the icier leftover scraps that formed outside of the orbit of Jupiter and out farther than the orbit of Pluto, even out in the Oort cloud. So because things are farther from the sun out there, they were colder, so more ice and cold things like ammonia and carbon dioxide dry ice came together and coalesced into the bits that then became the giant gas planets and became smaller, minor planets like Pluto, and then the leftover bits that didn't become planets became the comets out there. And so there's a compositional difference between asteroids and comets, but they're sort of the same idea.
And so these asteroids, how big are they? I mean, obviously, if they're the leftover crumbs, they probably vary quite a bit in size.
They do, and that's what makes it really interesting trying to figure out where they all are. So we know about how much mass there is in terms of asteroid and comet mass in the solar system because we know how the planets move. And we can tell, okay, if the planets are moving in this way, then according to Newton's laws that we all learned our first year of astronomy school in college, we know that there's other mass in the solar system that's tweaking the orbits to move a little bit, so we can tell there's about this much. Now, we do know that that's not all in one place, that it's scattered through the asteroid belt, it's scattered through the Kuiper belt for the comets, and then the Oort cloud, which surrounds the solar system, which is sort of a deep space realm of comets that are a lot colder that don't come into the inner solar system very often. We know that they're out there in chunks. We don't necessarily know where all those chunks are, and we don't necessarily know how big they are. They range in size from tiny little dust specks the size of a piece of glitter, all the way up to things like the object that hit in Russia a couple of weeks ago that was the size of a rail runner train car, up to something the size of the Cretaceous-Paleogene impact that killed the dinosaurs, which would have been 5 miles across.
That was an asteroid.
That was an asteroid. We know that. And up to bigger things the size of Pluto that are out in the Kuiper belt with Pluto and Eris and the other minor planets out there. So they really range. They can go anywhere from tiny, tiny, tiny up to maybe 400 miles across.
Now, Pluto was demoted from planet status. What
is
it, an asteroid now?
It's not an asteroid. It's considered to be a minor planet. So Pluto is big enough that its mass has enough gravity to pull it into a sphere. And so that means that it's a minor planet, but it wasn't formed by exactly the same processes that make a planet like Mercury or Venus or the Earth or Jupiter or Neptune, the outer gas giant planets. So we say it got about halfway there. Like, it didn't quite finish baking, to go with the bakery analogy.
Right, right. So the asteroids that are in the asteroid belt in the inner planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, etc., inside of Jupiter, what is their orbit like? Do they kind of hang out orbiting with all the other planets?
So some of them have very circular orbits. Like in the asteroid belt, they tend to hang out in pretty stable circular orbits. They go around in the asteroid belt, which tried to become a planet, didn't quite make it, got ripped apart again. So now they're all there just in their circular orbit, bashing into each other, grinding themselves to dust over time. Now, the tricky ones
are... They crash into each other all the time?
They do sometimes crash into each other, yeah. And so they're actually grinding themselves down to smaller and smaller pieces over time. The tricky ones, though, are the what we call the near-Earth asteroids and the potentially hazardous objects, or PHOs. So near-Earth asteroids are objects that maybe have a circular orbit that is co-orbital with the Earth, so in our same neighborhood right around our planet, that maybe passes us once in a while. They may have a very elliptical orbit, so it's not a circle, it's stretched. So it might cross all the way from the orbit of Mars or the asteroid belt in past the orbit of Earth and cross our orbit. And those we worry about, because if they're crossing the same part of orbit when we are, that's when we get hit. And so we like to keep track of those. There are a lot of telescopes in the world that are watching them, making sure we know where they are, what their orbits are, and making sure that they don't come too close to us.
So it's something other than academic interest. I mean,
you could
make a case that the other planets are like, to studying them is to expand human knowledge. But
Sure. This
asteroid stuff, I mean, well, you're going to be talking about this tonight, but this question, can you protect the Earth from asteroids?
Well, that's a really good question. And the answer is maybe still. So there are a fair number of people around the world that are thinking about this now, especially now that we've had the Chelyabinsk impact, and looking at different ways to do this. And it really seems to depend on the size of the object. So the first thing we have to do is know where they all are. So there are surveys that are being done to check, okay, where are these things? What orbits are they on? Are they at risk of hitting us? And the ones that are coming close to us, we call potentially hazardous objects. And those are objects that come at some point in their orbit within about 7 million miles of the Earth's orbit. Now, keep in mind that the Earth moves really fast. We are on this planet hauling around the solar system at about 1 million miles a day. And so if something's crossing our orbit, then we want to know about it, and that's potentially a risk to us. And if it's something that's coming within about a week's travel time from the planet, we need to keep an eye on that. So those are the ones that we really want to pay attention to and find aggressively. So the first job is to find them. Once we find them, then the question is, can we do anything about them, or should we do anything about them? So there was an object called Apophis that came past the Earth in 2004, and we just had another close approach this winter. And we've been watching it very, very carefully. Astronomers are taking radio measurements of it to get its shape. People with optical telescopes are watching it to try and find out what it's made of and how big it is and exactly what sort of orbit it's on. And there was a question for quite a while back in 2004, 2006, was Apophis going to hit the Earth? Because it's a big object. It is about 10 times larger than the one that hit Chelyabinsk. So it would have been, in fact, let's see, 3 times larger than the one that hit in Meteor Crater, Arizona. So this would have been something that would have been a real risk. It would have hit the ground, it would have made a big crater, it would have been a problem. And so that one we kept an eye on, and there was a lot of debate, should we push it out of the way, should we mess with it, should we leave it on its
orbit?
Can
you push it out of the way?
That, we're not really sure.
I mean, that's like an adventure movie.
It is, it's totally Hollywood. So there are a lot of suggestions about what to do, and it really seems to depend on the mass. So something like the size of Chelyabinsk, we probably could have pushed that out of the way if we had known about it in time. The question is, would you want to, or would you just want to tell people, hey, duck and cover at this time on this day, and then we'll replace your windows? It depends which is cheaper and which is safer. For things that are bigger, where it might actually hit a city and destroy it, then you start to look at things that maybe you need to be pushed out of the way. And there's different ideas of ways to do that.
What are some of those?
So there's two classes of ideas. There's the fast push and the slow push. And the question is, how much warning time do you have? So for some of these things, we know their orbit really well, and we can tell where it's going to be in 200 years. So if we know, oh, this thing might hit us in 200 years, then you can do all these sneaky things like potentially painting it with something shiny so that sunlight pressure pushes on it in a different way than it normally would.
Painting it.
And that's one of the ideas that's been floated. I'm not sure that'll work, because when you're out in space, the dust on an object, like we know this from the moon, from the Apollo missions, that dust on the moon gets electrostatically charged by sunlight and it hovers. So some people have suggested, well, we could paint the asteroid, it'll be shiny, the sunlight will push it in a different way that'll knock it off its orbit over 2 centuries.
Paint it with what?
With, that's a good question, maybe powdered metal, something shiny, glitter. It's jokingly referred to as the glitter bomb idea.
I mean, that it wouldn't just burn off as it moves?
Well, that's the question. It might not burn off, but it might get covered by other dust, and then it wouldn't be shiny anymore. But it's an idea that people are talking about. Another one is another totally sci-fi idea, thinking about solar sails or gravity tractors. So with a gravity tractor, it's like putting a carrot in front of a donkey, only in this case, it's a big piece of mass of something, of rock or something like that, where you put that out in front of the asteroid and you push that with your rocket as something as big as your rocket can hold. And you put that right in front of the asteroid and gravity exerts a little bit of attraction on that and pulls it just inch by inch out of the way. But if you've got 200 years to do that, that sort of timescale makes that work. Another idea that's operates under shorter timescales would be an idea out of Scotland called the laser bees idea, where you send solar-powered spacecraft with big lasers up to orbit near this asteroid, and you shine the laser on it, which vaporizes a little bit of material, and by the rocket effect, that material flying off of the asteroid pushes it in the other direction, and then you knock it off orbit that way, which would happen over the course of maybe 50 to 100 years.
That's the best idea yet.
It's pretty cool. That one is pretty cool. And then the question is, if you don't have a lot of warning time, if you have maybe a year's warning time, or if the object is big, you can only do these sorts of slow push ideas with smaller objects, things that are maybe 250 meters across, maybe the size of an office building. If you get things that are bigger than that, hopefully we see them coming earlier because they are bigger, but not necessarily. If it's coming from the Oort cloud that is out of the plane of the solar system, so it's falling in someplace we don't usually look with a telescope, we might not see it until it's 6 months out. In that case, that becomes much more of a planetary emergency. Thankfully, a rare one. These things that are that big, that are maybe half a mile across, only hit us every maybe 500,000 million years. So that's at least blessedly rare. But when we think about something like that happening, then you need to start thinking about taking mass away from it or shoving it very hard off of its path very quickly. And at that point, you're starting to look at things like large cannonballs or like nuclear devices. And so that's...
So you get that guy in the cowboy and Dr. Strangelove.
Something like that. Yeah, that's the image that comes to mind. But really, those of us that think about this stuff are trying to be a lot more careful with it. Because politically, when you talk to people in national governments in the U.S., in Russia, in the United Nations, the first reaction is, oh, well, we can just nuke it. It'll be great. It'll get it out of the way. And those of us who study this sort of thing in detail like to think that maybe we need to run the numbers a little more carefully than that. So that's part of what I do up at Los Alamos. Is
glad to hear it.
I do computer calculations to very carefully study, all right, what really would happen if you light off a nuclear device on the surface of a comet or an asteroid? Do we really know that? And what's in the back of my mind when I'm doing this is, so I grew up on the West Coast, and there's an amazing story about this very large, I think it was a gray whale, or some very large humpback whale maybe, died off the coast of Oregon and washed into this little cove that it was really sad. The local people were trying to take care of it. It didn't work. The thing passed away. And so it came time to give it a burial of some sort. And it was too large to bury in the sand. It was in too small of a cove to bring in a tugboat to tow it back out to sea. So they're stuck with this whale on the beach, and it's starting to rot. They don't know what to do with it. So somebody in town decides, oh, well, we can get some dynamite and blow it up, and that'll get rid of all the pieces. And so they brought in some munitions experts who were experts in explosives, not so much experts in whales. And they loaded it full of explosives, and they lit it off. And the videos are YouTube gold to this day. Fortunately, no one was hurt, but pieces of whale, rotting whale flesh the size of the table we're sitting at, were raining down on cars in the area. And it was just a complete mess. And so that's one of the stories I heard growing up. And that's what I think of when people say, oh, we should just nuke it. Because we don't really necessarily know what the effects are going to be. And so that's why I and a few other people in the world are studying this very carefully, because there aren't that many people in the world who know both asteroids and explosives. And because I'm one of them, I'm doing that math a little more carefully. So if, unfortunately, something big comes at us, then maybe we'll have a better idea of what to do or what not to do.
We're talking to planetary scientist Catherine Plesko. So you had a big week when this Russian asteroid hit.
It was a big week. So there were actually two events that week. There was asteroid 2012 DA14 that came past very close to the Earth. It came between the Earth and the Moon and passed through a very important orbital belt for satellites. And so the big thing that NASA and astronomers were watching for that was, would it run into a satellite? Because it's pretty crowded up there in geosynchronous orbit. That's where all of our satellites are for our cell phone navigation, for GPS. That's where a lot of our communication satellites are. That's really important. So if it ran into a satellite, or satellite ran into it, then the debris from that collision could really mess up geosynchronous orbit, and that gets really ugly for those of us down here on Earth. So we were watching that. Nothing happened. It went through. It was fine. Great. Then the Earth travels another 1,000,000 miles in its orbit. We wake up a day later, and boom, something hits Russia. So one of the first questions I got asked is, why is it always Russia? Because the last thing this big to hit Siberia in 1908. It was the Tunguska event. And so why is Russia always getting picked on? And it's pretty simple, actually. It's because Russia is the country with the biggest landmass. And so it's more likely to hit the more square feet you have to hit. So it's most likely that something like this would hit over the ocean. Russia's next, then I think Canada, and down the line.
Did you not, you people who watch asteroids, not see it coming because you were so focused on the other one?
It's not because of that. It's because it was small. So the problem is asteroids are moving fast. When they're coming at us, we might see them moving, but if they're on the right orbit the way they're coming at us, they'll look stationary. So it'll look to a telescope like a star that's just very faint and very far away. And it's hard to tell the difference sometimes when you're doing the all-sky surveys that look for these things. So that's part of it. Part of it is that they're very dark, so they're very faint objects for the size that they are. And part of it is that all-sky surveys are really expensive to do. So it takes very big telescopes. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of computational effort to take all of that data from all of those super, super high resolution pictures of the sky that are being taken both in the northern and southern hemisphere now, but not at a very deep resolution. So there's a limit on the size of things we can see. There's a limit on how soon we're going to see them. And then there's a computational limit on us doing the math on those images to actually say, oh, hey, that one's moving. And if it's on one of those orbits where it's coming straight at us and doesn't look like it's moving from our perspective, we might not notice that. It might come up as, oh, there's a new star over there. Is that an asteroid or is it a supernova? We don't know yet.
Right, right.
And then it hits.
Now, what was the experience like for the people on the ground in Russia? I mean, there was a lot of cell phone footage of this.
There is. Oh, my goodness. It was not as bad as it could have been. If it had been a bigger object, it would have been more of a problem. But what they saw was a big streak through the sky. It would have started out looking like a regular meteor. Then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. They would have seen an explosion because light travels faster than sound, of course. So they'd see it before they hear it. And then, so as this thing is coming down through the thinner part of the atmosphere, it heats up, even though the air is very, very thin, just like watching a space shuttle come in. Or something landing like that, it heats up from friction from the air coming past it. So you see that first. Then it hits a certain point in the atmosphere where the air is dense enough that it's going fast enough that it exceeds the speed of sound and creates a sonic boom. And as it's coming in, it's getting hotter and hotter on its surface. It shattered. There were actually three explosions that happened as this thing was coming down, where it shattered apart and parts of it shattered apart again, such that on the ground, only tiny sort of gravel gumball-sized pieces have been found. But on its way down, it did go through a couple of sonic booms that were so strong it actually created a magnitude 2.7 earthquake on the ground that registered in the seismic network. And the atmospheric blast was so strong that meteorological stations in Antarctica registered it.
Oh my goodness.
It was amazing. So it would have been like being around a really big explosion. So like a really, really big firecracker. It would have been all of a sudden. But part of the problem is because there's no real reference point when you're looking at something coming through the air like that so far up in the sky, you can't tell if it's really big and farther away or if it's just really close and a little bit smaller. So you don't know necessarily as this thing is coming down whether you should whip out your cell phone camera and go take a video or whether you should go hide in a closet somewhere away from flying glass. You just can't tell.
Well, and you said duck and cover a moment ago, and mm-hmm. and it's like that's such a cliche of stupidity from our nuclear past.
It
but
is.
For this, it might have actually been a good thing to do.
It might have been. So when a meteor comes through the atmosphere like this and hits us, it's not radioactive. There's no thermonuclear fission or fusion going on. It's just a really big boom because it is something the size of an office building flying into our atmosphere at a speed that's faster than a fighter jet. So it's a lot of energy. It's a lot of mass. When that hits the atmosphere, you get a big boom.
Now, how long have we been aware of asteroids?
We've been aware of asteroids for all of human history. We've known that comets come by for all of human history. They've been omens and portents, and people have tried to use them to predict the future. We've known about asteroids. We've known about meteor showers for all of human history. When you go deep out into the country, like up into the Jemez or up into the Sangre de Cristos on a really dark night and you look up, even if there's not a meteor shower, you're going to see meteors falling. You'll see maybe a couple of minutes and then, or a couple of an hour rather, and then a couple of minutes during a meteor shower or more. And so every night our ancestors would look up and see these things. They didn't necessarily know what they were,
now,
but
are
they
meteors
would have known about meteorites falling, meteorite metal, because that was used by our early ancestors before we started mining it.
Are meteorites asteroids?
Meteorites come from asteroids. So it's an asteroid when it's out in space, and then it is a meteoroid when it's coming into Earth's atmosphere. That's the massive part of it, the chunk. It's a meteor is the streak that you see coming through the atmosphere, and then once the thing explodes and falls to the ground or just lands, then that piece of rock or whatever is a meteorite.
Now, when these things land on Earth, when asteroids, for example, land on Earth, as this one did, or the one that killed the dinosaurs, mm-hmm. what is its effect on the atmosphere and chemistry and everything of the Earth? I mean, why did the dinosaurs die?
Because it was really, really big. So it's all about the energy of the impact. So this thing, that the impact that killed the dinosaurs, when the front part of that hit in the Yucatan, when that touched the ocean, it was so big that the back side of it was still out in space. That thing was absolutely huge. And coming again from Newton's laws that we learned in high school physics, force equals mass times acceleration. So acceleration is a property of the planet. So things are coming in at a set acceleration because of the mass of the planet. And the mass of the object then is the other part of that. And so because it was so massive, it was so much energy when it hit into the Yucatan, all of that energy going into one place, slamming into that one part of the planet, then everything heats up right there. The inside of that crater would have been hotter than the surface of the sun. And then once you got all of that mass compacted and heating up right there, it just explodes. And so that explosion kicked debris up into space and then back down onto the planet. Things were raining down through the atmosphere for quite a while.
All over the whole planet.
All over the whole planet. And so that actually, in the area of the Yucatan, in the Western Hemisphere, of course, the heat from the blast would have killed everything within hundreds of miles. And the earthquake would have killed any animals standing on the surface as far away as Texas. The tsunamis went as far away as the Gulf Coast of Texas as well. So there's the immediate effects there, but then also you have all of this debris that then is circulating in the atmosphere and is going back out into space and re-impacting, and that stuff then blankets the planet. So you lose sunlight for quite a while, it changes the climate radically, but the reason it does all of that is not just because it's an asteroid, but because it's a really big asteroid.
Right.
So the searches we have for asteroids and comets that might come near the Earth now, we know from those that there's nothing that big coming at us at all. So we're lucky there.
Good to know.
Yes, and they're marching down in size. So that one was 5 miles across. Now we're marching down to look for things that are 1 mile across and make sure there's nothing like that coming at us. And then we'll go down in size from there.
Why were dinosaurs more vulnerable than other life forms?
Dinosaurs, we think, were more vulnerable because they were so evolved into special little niches in their ecosystem. So they really, really depended on a specific type of food, or they didn't want the air temperature to change too much, or they wanted to nest in only a certain type of place. And so they were so evolved into their little specialist niches that when the climate changed that radically, they just couldn't handle it. The things that survived are things that burrowed, scavengers, things that could eat not just plants or animals, but also things that weren't going to get indigestion from eating dead stuff. And we see in the fossil record that not only is there the layer of meteorite dust, the iridium layer in the soil that you can even see here in Colorado, but at that layer, in a lot of places, it's churned up because the things that survived were trying to dig underneath that part of the soil and get down to whatever food was under the ground that didn't burn. And so that's things like that survived. And of course, trees, plants that make seeds, those things that were hiding in the soil didn't get cooked.
Very, very interesting. Well, much more to talk about, but it's time to go. Catherine Plesko is a planetary scientist at Los Alamos National Laboratory. And once again, tonight at 6 o'clock, she will lead a student discussion on Heads Up, Protecting the Earth from Large Asteroid Impacts. It's at the O'Keefe Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue, and it's part of the Santa Fe Alliance for Science Cafe for Young Thinkers, and everybody is welcome. Young people get priority. There's refreshments, and it's just been great having you on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Houston Johansson. He is a member of the City Charter Review Commission. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. How are you?
It's great to have you on the air. I am fine and glad to see you here. Now, the City Charter is something that I, until recently, didn't even know existed. It's basically the constitution of the city of Santa Fe, so to speak.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And I wouldn't feel bad, Mary Charlotte. I think many people in the community are not fully aware of the existence of this document or what it is. But we have we operate under a home rule system here in Santa Fe, so it means we have a lot of autonomy vis-a-vis the state government. And the backing of that home rule system is the city charter. It is very much like the Constitution of the United States. It outlines all the powers that government will have here in the local government system. It'll outline the different powers that the members will have. So it talks about what the mayor's powers will be, the council's powers will be, how they will interact with the populace, the rights that we have vis-a-vis that. And it outlines all that very nicely so that we can then have a functioning government based upon that.
Now, I take it this has not been in existence for 400 years.
No, we did not have one until sometime in the 90s. I apologize, I don't remember the exact date. We moved to a home rule system then and put together a first city charter that was then amended in the mid-2000s. One of the things that came out of that review process in the mid-2000s is actually things like public financing and automatic runoffs. So, you know, the document is quite important in the sense that it, you know, puts these kinds of things into play.
So it's a document like the Constitution that is a living document. It's apparently longer than the United States Constitution.
Yes,
as
yes.
These things can be. But can be amended every so and so many years. And you are actually on the commission that's looking at, is it functioning well now? Does it need any changes?
Yeah, so as I understand it, under state law, every 10 years, we have to appoint a commission to look at the city charter, solicit public input, and then make recommendations for how to update it, if there is indeed updating needed. There's no mandate that we have to change anything. The last one, like I said, was in the mid-2000s. We have been, new commission was appointed last December. I am one of 9 members. Each councillor got to appoint 1 member, and the mayor also did. And we have had 4 meetings. In those 4 meetings, we've gotten a lot of input from each other and a handful of concerned citizens who have come to us to voice their opinion about what they think the charter should look like. We also now have put in place a process for how we're going to move forward with the remainder of the meetings. And we're very eager to really get into the nitty-gritty of these issues. We've got about 20 issues that we've heard about so far. Some of them will simply not be doable because of state laws. Others will require more information before we can make a decision. But we really would like to get more people in the room telling us what they want. You know, as with all things in city government, turnout is often very low. So you get the same 5 or 10 concerned citizens in the room every time. And that's great. We love them. But it would be nice to have a bigger cross-section in of the town coming in. And to that effect, we're actually going to be going out to the different city council districts and having meetings there in the hope that that'll make it easier for people to attend.
And that's one of the reasons we're having you on the radio today, is to make people aware of this, that if they want to go to these meetings and let their voices be heard, they can do so. Now, one of the things, I mean, we have this weird situation right now where, for example, Washington and Colorado have legalized marijuana, but it's still illegal in the United States of America. Mm-hmm. So there's this question of federal law superseding state law. What happens?
Mm-hmm.
There's the same, presumably, dynamic going on here where you've got all kinds of federal and state laws, and then the city starts doing its laws, policies, ordinances, charter items. Do conflicts arise, or are mm-hmm. you there to prevent those kinds of conflicts arising?
You know, it's a really good question, because it is something we've begun grappling with. For instance, there's been a lot of talk about, say, having term limits put on councilors or on the mayor. At the moment, we are barred from doing that. State law forbids municipalities from having term limits on their elected officials. There was actually a big Supreme Court case, New Mexico Supreme Court case, a number of years ago in Albuquerque, where Albuquerque tried to impose these limits. The Supreme Court ruled that they could not. So if we were to go ahead and do that, it would be one of those things where we would either be testing the waters in anticipation of potentially going against the state again in a legal context. It would be that we're anticipating perhaps working with our legislators to get the law passed, or it could simply be that we put it in there in anticipation that when it does change, we're ready to go. The other option is we can always do something called a policy statement. So a policy statement is something that doesn't have any necessarily legal teeth. It is simply an articulation of what we as a community want. So, for instance, if you read the charter, you'll see there's a section on human rights. It isn't necessarily something that is legally binding, but it voices our support of treating people well and having dignity for all humans and things like that. So there are issues that come up where there are legal issues that we're going to run into. Our job is basically to weigh whether or not we want to wade into that territory, if it's truly worth it, and then decide if we do want to wade into it, do we want to make it actually part of the charter or do it in a policy statement. A lot of that will be driven by from what we hear from the community. You know, if only one person comes in and say they want term limits and 10 others say they don't, that's probably a good indication that this isn't worth, you know, garbling up the charter in anticipation of some battle or something else like that. It's also worth keeping in mind that all of our recommendations will then go to the city council, who will then have an opportunity to review it once more, solicit more public comment, before it then goes to the ballot in March 2014 so that we all can vote on it. So ultimately, we'll be the final deciders.
Right. Oh, that's very interesting. So we're talking about the charter of the city of Santa Fe. Now, what are some of the hot issues that are coming up that citizens are voicing their opinions about?
Well, you know, some of the bigger ones we've heard, of course, is things like gun control. You know, there's been a lot of talk about what we should do around that. There, of course, again, there are some legal issues with us attempting to regulate guns on a local level. So there's been talk about maybe looking at, you know, magazines and the size of those. There's been talk about putting a policy statement in there. There's a lot of debate about how we should approach that. There's been talk about marijuana. There's a lot of stuff around elections. You know, one of the bigger ones is putting redistricting into the hands of an independent commission so that the council isn't the one deciding that. Term limits is one we hear again and again and again. The issue of automatic runoffs come up a lot because, as you may know, it is in the city charter that we would have an automatic runoff system.
What's an automatic runoff?
It basically means that if you do not get a certain number of votes, like if you and I or three of us are going at it in an election, if we don't cross a certain threshold, we then, the top two, have to have an automatic election against each other. So you have to cross.
So if nobody gets over 50% or over 45% or whatever it is.
Yes, then nobody's won. So then the top two from that election would then have another race against each other.
Okay.
That has never been implemented, even though it's in the charter.
Has there been a moment where it would have been implemented? I mean, has that situation arisen?
Well, the reason it hasn't been implemented is really comes down to equipment. The equipment that we have access to that I believe is owned by the state does not have the software to allow this to be done, nor does it have the ability to do ranked choice voting, which is another thing that is supposed to be implemented but has yet to be. So of the things that were implemented, that were put in the charter before, the public financing has worked out, but some of the stuff around how we actually count voting has not made it through.
It's a software thing, essentially.
That's my understanding, and the city doesn't really have the money at this moment to buy its own voting equipment. So then there becomes a question of, well, we could do it by hand. So there's a lot of, even once the charter is amended, there then becomes the actual execution of the policies that can get difficult, as this would illustrate.
When you look at the charter, I mean, it has a lot of things that are not in themselves policies at all, but they're about result, again, like you're talking about results of elections and petitioning the government and recall and things like that. But we have recall provisions for elected officials within the city.
Yes, we do. You could, if you felt that your councilor or the mayor was doing a very poor job after their first year in office, you could go out, and I can't exactly remember what the threshold for signatures is, but you could initiate a recall process against them. If you fail, you cannot attempt to recall them again during that term.
Right.
And to my knowledge, I don't believe anyone has actually ever been recalled. That may be incorrect, but I don't believe anyone has.
Right. And certainly not in the time that I've lived here that I recall, and it's been quite a while. So when you go out into the different districts, which you're about to do, and get people activated, where are you going to be? When are you going to be? What are you going to tell people that this is all about? Because what I'm getting at is, it's so interesting to me that there are these documents which basically really shape our lives in ways that we're not conscious of. But when you look at them, they seem kind of boring and bureaucratic, but they really are quite important.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't they are a little boring and bureaucratic, and that's just how, you know, when you get the lawyers involved, that's how it's going to be. And that's probably for the best. You know, it makes things a little less ambiguous, or that's the hope. Our first district meeting will be this Thursday down at City Hall. That'll be the District 1 meeting. Then I believe we're going out to the Southside Library in 2 weeks. I think the next one will be at the Chavez Center 2 weeks after that. And I apologize, I cannot remember where the fourth district meeting will be held. But we do have a Facebook page and a Twitter page that you can find all this on. Our Facebook page is Santa Fe Charter Review Commission, and our Twitter page is SF Charter Review. So we will be posting all this up there. There is also, if you do a quick Google search for Santa Fe Charter Review, you can find the website that's been set up for us by the city. When we get in there, you know, we will, assuming we have new faces, that is, at the meeting, go through a little brief history of what we're up to. And then what we intend to do is at each of these meetings sort of begin delving into the issues that we've already heard, so that we can begin hashing those out while also soliciting new input. So at the next meeting, I believe we're going to be going through the election issues that we've heard about, so things like redistricting, things like you know, having a strong mayor system, things like term limits. We'll begin to really hash those out.
What's a strong mayor system?
So right now the way we operate is we have a strong council city manager system. So most of the political and decision-making power rests with the council and the city manager. The mayor has very limited power. He can appoint the city manager and he can vote in a tie, but that's about it. Most of the power is really with the manager and council. There are some that think we should move to a strong mayor system where he would effectively become more of the chief executive of the city, have tremendous, you know, much more decision-making power, would be able to participate in all voting matters, things like that. So it would really shift the power away from the manager into the hands of an elected official. There are pros and cons on both sides. And actually, I should say, that's one of the struggles we're really having. Is there's a lot of interesting ideas out there, like this strong mayor system. We as individuals on the commission do not necessarily know enough about it to make a good decision. We also don't necessarily have enough time to do in-depth research on 20 issues. So we've been trying to get people who come to us with these ideas to go out and maybe bring us some additional information, bring us pros and cons. So if anyone out there, you know, thinks they know a lot about one of these issues or comes to a meeting and thinks they know a lot and would like to present information, I would very much encourage them to do so. That would help us immensely because otherwise we're kind of shooting in the dark.
We're talking to Houston Johansson, who is a member of the City Charter Review Commission. Are there issues that come up, and I think a lot of these things come up in city council meetings that are where ordinances are being considered and things like that, but around, for example, things that didn't exist 20 years ago, mm-hmm. changing technologies, internet, cell phones, stuff like that, those are more things that have to do with laws and ordinances mm-hmm. than with kind of charter issues.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that we could, you know, hear about or talk about or discuss in these meetings that really ultimately do become more of a policy issue for the council to tackle. So, you know, how would you, you know, if we were talking about building, say, Wi-Fi throughout Santa Fe, that really becomes more something that the city staff and the city council needs to address, not us at the charter level. One of the risks of tweaking the charter is that you just start throwing everything you want in there, and now you have this 100-page document that is impossible to grapple with. I'm of the belief that we should keep it as simple as possible, as to the point as possible, to make sure that it's easy to understand and gives us the basic guiding principles we need to have a functioning government, not clutter it up with every idea that we've ever had. So a lot of things we, you know, there may be things that we simply say we're going to defer that to council, and, you know, if this group wants to pursue it, they should take it to the council.
Under what circumstances in city government does the charter even get referred to? Like, there's some issue and says, well, in the city charter it says, and then something gets resolved. Does that happen?
It does. I mean, I don't know that it happens all the time, but so, you know, if somebody was going to launch a recall, for instance, against the council, they would likely immediately begin referencing that. I think it's one of those things that whips out more when you really get into the nitty-gritty of daily politics down at City Hall. You know, there are probably certain times when councilors are, you know, moving in a certain direction and a concerned citizen or city staff might come in and say, you know, yes, that is all fine, but our charter says this, this, and this, so you can't go ahead and do that. And that also comes into play when we start dealing with state laws. You know, this whole gun control issue, there's a lot of concern that anything we try to do will simply be struck down because of the state constitution and its firm assertion that nobody can regulate basically the possession of firearms.
Right. This is all the stuff of the workings of democracy, which is very interesting because I was in a neighborhood meeting the other day and people were yelling at each other, and one of the city people said, democracy is messy and this is what it looks like. And when you look at stuff like this, it's like these are some of the sort of skeletal structures of this kind of crazy messy democracy that is, especially on a local level, a lot more influenced by citizens mm-hmm. than you might ever guess.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I say, you know, we're sitting in these meetings. We absolutely want people to come and talk to us. We're very much going to listen to everything they say and take it very much in consideration. And if a lot of people show up in support of this over that issue, that's going to carry a lot of weight compared to if nobody shows up and it's just the nine of us sitting in a room twiddling our thumbs. Citizens can have a lot of input here, and that's why, earlier in the show I said, you know, we would love to get more than the same committed 10 people in the room with us. They're great people. I love seeing them every time. We'd like to have a bigger cross-section in there so that we're making decisions that really reflect, you know, a broad consensus in the community.
Now, what is the timing? Is there a certain point by which any recommendations to change or amend the city charter, a timeline by which that has to be done?
Well, our goal is to have it on the ballot in March of 2014. To make that happen, we pretty much need to submit something to the council by early July to give them ample time to look it over. Of this year. To look it over, to make any revisions they see fit, and then to send it on to city staff to get it on the ballot. So we're looking at, you know, another, I don't know, what is that, 4 months, 5 months, something like that. Of working on this, which I think is a good amount of time. You know, we've set ourselves a reasonable deadline to have enough time to go to all the districts, have follow-up meetings, but we're not just giving ourselves an endless blank check to do nothing, which is good. So, you know, early July is basically our, as a commission, drop-dead date. But there will be another opportunity to go haggle over it with City Council if there are still concerns.
Houston Johansson, you ran for city council last time around. are you, and you were really representing the youth vote in a lot of ways and sort of the whole issue of young people in Santa Fe, which I know is an ongoing interest of yours. Are you planning on staying in politics?
Well, you know, I did run last year. I had a great experience with it. I mean, it truly was a transformative experience going out there and meeting with voters and competing with Councilor Boucher. And I very much do want to stay in politics, particularly local politics. I see this as being, you know, the most important level of government that we can focus on, and especially as we watch our leaders in Washington continue to twiddle their thumbs and allow things to go to hell in a handbasket. I do believe that we as communities really need to work together and strengthen ourselves. So I do want to stay involved. I would like to someday run again. I don't know when that will be or for what position that will be. I certainly would love to come back on this show when I decide and let you know and let your viewers know. But you know,
I always have all the candidates on. It's really great.
I'm sure it's great to see all of us, especially last time. We had a great slate of candidates across
everybody
the city.
Everybody was good. It was the most extraordinary city council election ever because everybody was awesome.
Oh, yeah. No, I was very excited. We had a lot of good candidates and more than one candidate in each district, which isn't always the case.
Yeah.
Which is actually, speaking of fun elections, there is a Santa Fe Community College Board election next week that your viewers may or may not be aware of. And there is another great slate of candidates for those two at-large positions. So
nice.
I encourage everyone to go vote in that election on Tuesday. And, you know, like I said, there's a lot of good candidates for that. But I do want to stay involved. Just my involvement with the Charter Commission should show that. I have little doubt that my running for office helped, you know, put me in the limelight enough to get appointed to this position. And I'm very grateful for that.
I think it's just, I mean, I don't think I would go into politics myself for all the tea in China. And that that whole way, I don't know what it is, the sort of political animal thing. You have to really enjoy it.
Well, there is, you know, it's got its ups and its downs. But for me, it's you know, the one-on-one with the people in the community that really inspired me and made me want to keep going. I mean, yes, some of the meetings are a little dry and boring and a little tedious, but when you get out there and you start talking to people about what they want in their community and their hopes and dreams, it's truly inspiring, and it makes you really want to go the extra mile and work really hard. And, you know, I love it. Like I said, I don't love every aspect of it every moment, but on a whole, it's a great experience, and I certainly can't blame you for maybe not wanting to do it. You do kind of get stuck out there under the microscope, rather, quite a bit.
So, once again, if people are interested in coming to these meetings, there's a bunch of them happening, and you can go online and, I guess, just put in your search engine Santa Fe City Charter or Santa Fe Municipal Charter, and you'll be able to figure out when and where all of these different meetings are.
Yes, that's right. I mean, if you do a quick Google search, you'll be able to find, for Santa Fe Charter Review Commission, you'll be able to find the website that the city set up for us. And actually, we're going to soon enough have a function on that website to solicit input from members of the community, so you can go on there and actually type your ideas into a survey we're going to put up. So if you are unable to make a meeting, that'll be another way for you to participate in this process. We also do have a Facebook page, as I mentioned, Santa Fe Charter Review. And then we also
Facebook.com/Santa Fe Charter Review.
Yes. And then we also have a Twitter page, which is Twitter.com/SF Charter Review. And we'll be posting regular updates of when our meetings are and what's happened at those meetings on both of those things. And our next meeting is this Thursday at 4 p.m. down in Council Chambers in City Hall. That will be our District 1 meeting. Certainly, if you're not from District 1 and want to come, please do. Like I said, we'd love to get as many people in the room talking about what they want as possible. And that meeting, I believe, will be specifically focused on election issues. Not that you can't bring other ideas to the table, but we're going to begin sort of reviewing the, I don't know, 10 or so ideas that we've gotten around elections, like, you know, redistricting in a independent commission, like term limits, things like that, and begin weighing the pros and cons of all those.
And let's get some computer people to show up and some hardware and software people to show up and maybe see if they've got any ideas how some of these things which are already in the charter could be implemented that we don't have supposedly don't have the equipment for. Maybe there's some creative ways of solving that problem. Houston Johansson is a member of the City Charter Review Commission. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Have a good day.